Welcome back to another episode of That's Disturbing. I'm Gail.
And I'm Daphne.
And this is episode 5.
Yeah, I thought it'd be cute to say what episode we're on until we hit episode 10, and that'll be boring for us and everybody else.
Yeah.
So from now until episode 10, you'll hear what episode it is. But this is episode 5. So don't fret. This is episode 5. The disturbing fact of the day. Get a load of this. Some ants, they turn into zombies via parasitic fungus, which manipulates their brain. Have you ever heard of that?
No, I haven't.
Okay. The reason why I picked that disturbing fact was because I'm watching the new season of Down to Earth with Zac Efron. And they do, you know how they do different segments in that show of whatever, like, that episode is related to, whatever topic?
Yeah.
They did one on mushrooms. So they talked about the zombie mushroom in Australia.
And so ants...
Yeah, they, like, basically pick at their brains, and then they turn into, like, the zombie-like state these ants do.
Oh, that's so weird.
It's a mushroom that does this.
Yeah, how do, who did that study? That's what I really want to know.
I don't know.
Because I feel like that's disturbing that somebody took the time to study ants. And how would they know if they were zombies versus having normal thought? Like, it's an ant.
Well, I do know that once something eats the zombified ant, right? Because that's this... circle of life is that bugs eat other bugs, which then small critters eat those bugs and so on, that like infection transfers from one host to the next.
Okay.
Isn't that creepy and weird?
That is creepy and weird.
Also, I have another announcement.
Okay.
Which isn't really much of an announcement if you listen to episode 4. But Mom, did you know we have a website?
Ooh, I've heard tell of this.
That's disturbingpodcast.com. Did you know that we have an Instagram?
I do, and people need to follow us.
Yeah, they do. Get on it. At That's Disturbing Podcast. And did you know that we have a Gmail?
Yes. Yes. You're very proud of your Gmail.
I am. I set it up all by myself.
Good job.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
All right. Shall we get on with it?
We shall. We shall.
Okay. So I'm doing The Preppy Killer. And this is a case from the 1980s. And let's see, the guy's name was Robert Chambers. So I guess we'll just start with the case.
Okay.
I guess what I'm going to preface this by saying that what happened was I thought I knew this case. I was like, oh yeah, I can whip this out really super quick because I'm working on one that's taking me a lot longer. And then when I started working on it, I'm like, oh man, I don't know half of what I thought I knew. And the more I looked, the more I found out. And so my notes hopefully are in the closest to best order, but I things just kept happening. And so I'm just going to go the very best that I can. And anyway, so here we go. So on August 26th of 1986, around 6 a.m., Pat Riley, who was on her bicycle, saw the strangled and half-naked body of 18-year-old Jennifer Levin behind the Metropolitan Museum of Art in Central Park in New York City. First, she saw a person and she didn't know what it was exactly. And then she got closer and then she realized, oh crap, this is like a dead person. So she goes to a payphone, she calls the police, and then she rides her bike back over to Jennifer Levin because she feels like she shouldn't leave her alone because she's obviously like a young girl and she just feels like she's brokenhearted and sad. And all the stuff that this lady said later, like in interviews and stuff, but she said it forever changed her life because she was a woman who was a trader on Wall Street, and which was not very common back in the mid 80s. And she felt like she was kind of invincible. And then when that happened, she thought, I'm not invincible anymore.
Yeah, as that would do to you. Also, okay, so I have two comments about that. One, it's bullshit that you have to go to a payphone to be able to call the police. You have to pay to report a crime to the police. That's bullshit that you have to go to a payphone to pay to do a good deed.
I don't know if you do have to pay if you're calling 911.
Well, if you do, that's bullshit.
But there weren't cell phones. Or there were, but like not.
There were pagers at the time, right?
Yeah, in the 80s. And there were cell phones, but there were those big giant brick things. And so I don't think, you know, she's on her bicycle. She's not going to have a big giant brick phone.
They were big giant brick things. Okay, Mom.
Yeah,
they were huge. Says the person who probably had a big giant brick thing.
No, I didn't. I was not. No giant brick phone.
And also, yeah, that sucks. That's really sad. That would definitely change your life.
Yeah.
That horrible. Yeah, you're not invincible. Nobody's invincible. Let me just start by saying that. And yeah, that would change everything.
Yeah. So anyway, this lady was forever shook by this. And so when police arrived at the scene, they immediately surrounded the area with crime scene tape. They noticed that her body was badly bruised and she had scratches all over her face and neck. Her short pink skirt was pushed up around her waist almost, and her top was pushed up, exposing her bra. Her underwear was found more than 100 feet away from her body. Her jean jacket was laying next to her, and in her jean jacket was her wallet that had her learner's permit and her birth certificate. So that's how they found out her identity was Jennifer Levin. Her learner's permit had her real age of 18 years old, but her birth certificate had been altered to make her 4 years older, you know, presumably so she can go out to bars and stuff like that. But anyway, so since they knew who she was right away, they were able to, you know, notify the family and stuff. Jennifer was originally from Long Island, and she had moved to Soho to live with her dad and stepmom, which is like a trendy neighborhood in New York. It's city. And her dad had moved to Soho because he was a real estate agent. And so presumably, you know, his business is more lucrative if he's like in a trendy area. And then it, like, they had this loft, this walk-up apartment or whatever, that's kind of, you know, what New York is kind of known for. People have these brownstones, walk-ups, all this kind of, like, they're fancier type places.
They're so fancy apartments.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, we're from Colorado, so, I mean, we have those here, but it's not, I feel like it's not super coveted by us like it is, like, New York people, like, city people, super city people. Because, I mean, Denver's a city, but
no, it's not even close to being like that. There's, like, regular apartment complexes here, just average, that you would think about, that it's, like, either has an elevator or a flight of stairs, and it's, or, and it has, like, inner or outer exits, but it's one level most of the time. It's not this, like, grand townhouse or even, like, actual sized home within an apartment complex.
So anyway, she moved with her dad and stepmom because she wanted to be, you know, in the city and not be in Long Island anymore. And she attended a private school in Manhattan. And so it also made school more readily available for her. So she was known to hit the party scene with her friends, but she was also a studious girl and she was getting ready to go to college. She wasn't a big drinker or someone who liked to use drugs. They said she didn't use drugs, but she liked to socialize with her friends and have fun, you know, so presumably that's why she has her birth certificate that's saying that she's 22 instead of 18. But unfortunately, the media portrayed her as a party girl who was out of control. And according to her friends, this couldn't have been further from the truth. And that's where I say that I thought that I knew this case, because everything that I've ever heard about it was like, oh, she was a party girl and she just was in the scene and it just happened because basically she set herself up for it, which is not cool no matter what, not to be victim blaming, but she didn't set herself up for it. She didn't go out looking, like, she didn't go looking to get in trouble. And she didn't put herself in a lot of precarious positions that would have led to this situation. So anyway, like I said, she was a good girl. She was excited to go to college. She had just returned from a week in the Hamptons. So again, her friends are kind of more wealthy, upper middle class or upper class people. And so they have, like, these vacation homes in the Hamptons and they spend weeks at a time there on vacation, like, family's not there, parents aren't there.
So the people that she's associating with are, like, New York socialites, basically.
Yeah, or the kids of.
Okay, so the kids of New York socialites. So the high life of New York.
Exactly, exactly. And then also, you know, parents are traveling and kids have access to apartments and vacation properties and they're just partying and doing their thing. So, but they're also over 18. So the parents are, you know, I'm sure kind of semi-monitoring the situation, but probably not totally and completely. Anyway, on the night of August 25th, she met up with a couple of friends since she had just gotten back from the Hamptons. She's getting ready to go to college the following week, so she's trying to, like, hang out with everybody she knows, say goodbye, that kind of thing. She's going to school in Boston, which isn't really far away, but it's not in New York, obviously. Again, police knew who she was, so they went to notify her dad. They started interviewing her friends and asking them about where she had been the night before and if anybody had any information that could help them figure out who had done this to her. Everyone kept saying like the same thing. So she'd went out for Mexican food and drinks with a couple of friends. And then she went to this bar called Dorian's Red Hand. And it's on Manhattan's Upper East Side. And it's kind of like caters to these preppy kids, these young, preppy, hip, cool, you know, upper class kids. Everyone kept saying that when they last saw her, she was with Robert Chambers. So one friend's peeling off and is like, oh, she was with so-and-so and so-and-so and Robert Chambers. And another friend, oh, well, she was with so-and-so and so-and-so and Robert Chambers. So it keeps coming down to where basically Robert Chambers is the last person that she's been seen with. So police went to Chambers' home to talk to him, thinking that he could help them figure out who could have done this to Jennifer. When they get there, his mom answers the door and she woke him up so that he could talk to the police. And immediately when he comes to the door, they notice that he's covered in fresh, bloody scratches on both sides of his face. And so casually they're like, hey, you want to come down to the station with us so we can interview you and you can try to help us figure out what happened to Jennifer? And so he's like, yeah, sure, no problem. I'm happy to go with you and give you all the information that I possibly can.
Red flag.
Yeah. Exactly. At this point, obviously, to the detectives, he's a person of interest, but they're like not letting him know that. They're just kind of like, hey, dude, come and help us. See what you can help us figure out. And he's like, yeah, OK, cool, because I'm the smartest guy ever. And I know this. At some point when he's being interviewed, the lead detective, who ends up anyway being the lead detective on the case, Detective Mike Sheehan, notices that he has a broken right hand. And so it's broken like up in the hand part, like in the up high, like on the back of the palm of your hand, like the back side of your hand. And the detective said,
took you a long time to get there, the back of the hand.
Sorry, the back of the hand. And the detective called it like a boxer's fracture, an impact fracture. So like if you hit something really hard and you break your hand up higher. And then they asked him what happened to his face. And he said that they were scratches from his cat, that he was playing with his cat and he threw his cat up in the air. And then I know, right? He's a dick for even saying that.
I just made a face. That's where you got that from.
Right. Well, yeah, it's super douchey.
Super eye roll.
Yeah. So anyway, he says, if you think these are bad, look at these. And he takes his shirt off and he's got scratches all over his chest and his stomach. Police keep, quote unquote, talking to him and keep asking him, hey, what happened? What happened again? And he's like, yeah, we were at Dorian's and then we just parted ways. So yeah, I was hanging out with her and we parted ways. And so they just keep like pressing the situation over and over again. And so then the cop says, Sheehan says to him, he's like, hey, just tell me one more time about the last time that you saw Jennifer. And at this point, Chambers is getting cocky. Like, God, you guys are so stupid. You're not fucking listening to me. I've already told you 1,000 times. So he literally says to the detective, he says, pay close attention to me. And I'll tell you again that when we left Dorian's, we walked up 86th Street. So that's when his story changed. And Detective Sheehan said, oh, whoa, wait a minute. You literally have been saying all night that, or all day, because they're interviewing him during the day, that you were at Dorian's and then you guys both went your own separate ways. Now you're telling me that you walked down 86th Street directly towards Central Park. And he's like, so now you need to tell me exactly what happened. And at that point, Chambers becomes teary-eyed and mumbles, what's mother going to say?
A little Norman Bates, yeah?
Ew.
Right? What's mother going to say?
Yeah.
Gross.
A little Norman Bates, right?
Blech.
Right. So at this point, Detective Sheehan calls Steven Sirocco, who's Manhattan's assistant district attorney. And he's like, hey, can you come down to the station? Because I'm pretty sure we're about to get a confession from this guy who killed for that body that we found in the park this morning. And so when Sirocco got down to the station, okay, Chambers hadn't yet asked for a lawyer. And so they were like, hey, can we just get you to give us your real actual statement on videotape? And so we can know exactly what happened. At that point, Chambers has read his rights. Basically, they're like, hey, if you want a lawyer, you can have a lawyer. Everybody knows the Miranda rights, right? You don't want to speak unless you have an attorney present. You have the right to not speak, self-incrimination.
You have the right to remain silent.
Yeah, you have the right to remain silent.
Anything you say can and will be used against you in the court of law. You have the right to an attorney. If you cannot afford an attorney, one will be appointed to you. Something else of that nature, too. I had to learn that in high school.
Good job, Dad. Okay, and I'm glad to hear that you learned that in high school. It's not from firsthand information.
Is that from researching?
It is from researching, not from, like, being in police custody and having someone officially say that to you.
Oh, yeah, no, that hasn't happened.
Right.
Hang on, knock on wood.
Right, no, you're a good. You're a good kid. That won't happen. Okay, all right, so in his videotaped confession, or his quote-unquote recounting of his version of events, Chambers claimed that he wasn't interested in Jennifer at all, that she was the aggressor in the situation, and according to Chambers, he had declined her repeated requests for sex, and he was trying to leave when Jennifer tied his hands behind her back with his underwear, and then, so she straddles him, she sits, you know, she's sitting on top of him with her back, like, to his face. He's laying down. His hands are tied with her underwear behind his back, supposedly, right? And then she starts taking his pants off. And in his words, she starts jerking him off.
Yeah, how uncomfortable for a boy. Wow, how sad for him.
Right. But anyway, he said that it was painful. And at that point, he broke free from the underwear handcuffs and he grabbed her by the neck. And then she flipped over him and she landed by a tree. And he thought she was dead. But the way he said it, like, I don't know. It's just creepy. If you watch the police interview, he's like, oh, and then, you know, she seemed like she was dead or she didn't move or I don't know. He's just, and he's so like.
So is he claiming that she like hit her head or?
No, he's claiming basically that he accidentally snapped her neck.
Oh.
Yeah, because he said that he grabbed her by the neck and then she flipped over him. And then she landed by a tree. So basically he puts her in a chokehold, flips her over his back, flips her over on her back. And then she lands by the tree where she's found the next morning. And she's dead, right? So instead of trying to resuscitate her or calling the police, he just leaves her under the tree. And then as the police are arriving on the scene and beginning their investigation, he's across the street watching. So this all was happening. So the police are getting there. She called about 6 o'clock in the morning, the cyclist did. And the police are getting there by like 6:20, 6:30, something like that. And her time of death was reported to be about 5:30 in the morning. Yeah. And so also
that was fast that they found her body.
Right. And also saying that they left Dorian's at like 4:30 in the morning. So, yeah. So that's the time frame that we're looking at.
Yeah, I feel like his mother definitely wouldn't be happy with him in this moment. Yeah, speaking as a dog mom, I would be very upset with Pixie if she did anything like this.
Nice. I don't think that's a thing, but okay. All right. And so also bear in mind that Chambers is like 6'3", 6'4", and he's 190 pounds. And Jennifer's 5'8", and she's like 120 pounds. So she's tall, but she's real slender. So after his videotaped confession, Chambers asked to go home. And Detective Sheehan looks at him and is like, what don't you understand? You're under arrest for murder. And Chambers seemed shocked. Because it's like, hello, we just read your rights. And then you literally just gave us a videotaped confession.
Yeah.
So
dumbass.
Right. I'm not sure where the confusion was, except for, again, this kid's cocky and he thinks he's the shit. You know, he's a super douche. Chambers was booked and he was charged with murder. And after Chambers was arrested, he reportedly said to his father, the fucking bitch. Why didn't she leave me alone?
What?
Yeah.
What does that even mean?
That means that it's her fault. Like, she didn't leave me alone and now she's dead and now I'm in trouble. Like, he's basically saying that she raped him, that she was trying to forcibly have sex with him. But again, they left together. They walked together.
What a dick.
Yeah, total dick. So also of note, Chambers was supposed to meet a girl that he was dating. Her name was Alex Knapp, and he was going to meet her at Dorian's. And she wanted to talk to him because I watched this documentary. It was a 5-part series. It was on Sundance and it was recorded in 2019. And so way after this happened, and it's like her family and friends like recounting the story, but it's also people with that knew Chambers and were like giving information about him. So this girl, Alex Knapp, that he was dating, who was like way younger, she's like 16, the night before he had stolen money from her. And so she was like pissed and she was going to confront him, right? But she's also like in love with him because he's 19 and she's 16 and he's so cute and blah, blah, blah. And so anyway, so she's sitting there waiting for him to meet her at Dorian's, this Alex Knapp. Cap. So he was late to Dorian's. He was supposed to meet her at like 8 and he didn't show up till like 11:30. And if I were her, I would have fucking waited till 11:30, but whatever.
I wouldn't have waited for a sleazeball either that steals my money.
Right. But she's probably hanging out with her friends also. When he finally got there, he just walked by her and ignored her. And so she's like fuming pissed, right? And then Jennifer walks over to Chambers and she starts a conversation with him and she's like super flirty with him. And Alex goes, walks over to them and she throws a bunch of condoms at Chambers. And she says, you can use these with someone else. You won't be using them with me. And Chambers admitted later on that Jennifer laughed at him and so did the entire crowd at Dorian's and that it pissed him off that he was super mad that this happened, and he blamed Jennifer for Alex being mad, even though Alex is mad in the first place anyway because he fucking stole from her and then he's 3 hours late. But again, he's so never to blame.
He blames Jennifer for making him look bad when he's also engaging in conversation with Jennifer after he has a girlfriend and is being a sleazeball just all around.
Right.
Well, even though it takes two to tango, he's blaming her.
Well, yeah. And he's that nothing's my fault guy. Everything is someone else's fault.
Okay. Yeah. So he's just selfish and a dick.
Right.
Is what I'm getting from this.
Right.
Narcissist.
So anyway, that was just a side note of what potentially could have led up to this, right? Him being pissed off. So Chambers' account of the events. So in his videotape confession, what he said didn't line up with what Jennifer's body looked like. She was badly bruised. She was scratched and her face and her neck had really deep scratches. She had petechial hemorrhaging in her eyes, which is always from asphyxiation. So being strangled, not being able to breathe. It's when the capillaries are deprived of oxygen and they start to burst. So, and one eye was literally bulging out of her skull and she even had a bite mark on her.
That's so sad.
Yeah.
That breaks my heart.
So clearly not a chokehold that you were flipped over and then the person took off.
Right. That literally just snapped your neck and you died.
Right. Like this is
a struggle.
Yeah. This girl's like fighting for her life and she's being damaged along the way. Right. And it was later determined that some of the scratches were from Jennifer herself because they found her skin under her nails and they think, you know, obviously she was trying to free herself from being strangled. Her official cause of death was asphyxia due to strangulation.
That's so sad.
Yeah.
That's horrible.
It's really sad.
I hate this guy.
Yeah.
I don't feel sorry for him.
Oh, just wait.
I don't feel sorry for him at all.
Yeah.
He sounds like a self-concerned, preppy dickhead.
Yeah.
He sounds like if he existed today, he'd probably be wearing those chubby shorts and like Vineyard Vines t-shirt and drive a Jeep Wrangler. Lifted, of course.
I feel like you're stereotyping, so you might want to back up just a little bit.
I just feel like that's who he is.
Yeah. Well, that's who he was in 1986. So anyway, so Chambers had a history of drug abuse and theft. And again, he later admitted that he'd been addicted to drugs since he was 14 years old. He went to prestigious schools, like all the way from elementary school all the way up. And it was his mother's attempt to put him in what she considered to be, quote unquote, the right circles. His mom is an Irish immigrant. So she's not obviously originally from the United States. And they don't have a lot of money, even though like the press basically said that these were like two rich kids that were just partying and shit went bad. You know, that wasn't true. So his family was not wealthy. And again, his mom was just trying to put him in the right circles because she was a private nurse. And at one point she had even worked for Jackie Kennedy and she had set up a play date for Robert and John F. Kennedy Jr. And she kept getting mad at Robert the whole time because she said he wasn't saying the right things to be like hanging out with JFK Jr. But, you know, they're not friends. So anyway, I feel like the mom's a little bit delusional and you'll hear more of that as we go on. But so anyway, her putting him in these situations, it's like it gave him stress because he doesn't have money and he has a lot of pressure from his mom. Obviously, if you know, when he said, oh, what's mother going to say? You know, so obviously he has pressure from his mom. And so putting him in these circles, it just gave him access to drugs because, you know, readily available when you have money. But he didn't have the money for it. So he was stealing from people in order to support his drug use. And, you know, again, to be fair, his mom was just trying to put him into a circumstance so maybe he could come up and be wealthy. So she's seeing how the other half lives and she wants her son to live that way too. She doesn't want him to struggle, which is also nice and kind, but apparently, clearly she went about it the wrong way. But also he could have just been sociopathic and delusional and could have really had nothing to do with his mom, but maybe she fostered that or I don't know, made it worse than it already was. He had been kicked out of one school after another, and he was basically described as a problem child and an underachiever who lacked any kind of desire to succeed. And when this happened with Jennifer, he had just recently been kicked out of Boston University after one semester because he kept getting into trouble. The trouble he got into was stealing a credit card from someone that he knew, and he racked up a $3,000 bill on this girl's credit card. And he'd also been in trouble for just petty theft and drug and alcohol abuse. And, you know, he's stealing to support his drug habit. Anyway, so he was never charged with anything and there was no accountability for anything he did because the one kid who he was using the credit card with, the guy's dad was rich and the mom, Chambers' mom, convinced the girl's parents who he stole the credit card from not to press charges. They're like, the mom's like, oh, he has a drug problem. I'm going to send him to rehab. I'm so sorry. Please don't press charges.
Let me guess, he never went to rehab.
No, he did. But yeah, but he didn't stay. So anyway, so the rich kid who he was with, that dad, sent a cashier's check to the mom of the girls who they stole the credit card. And so everything was fine, good, whatever. But again, there's no accountability for this kid. Like he can do whatever he wants. So the press was all over this story right away. Her mom wasn't even notified. Her mom, Ellen, before the press had already like spilled the whole story, had her name out there. They were calling it the Preppy murder already. Everything's unfolding before even the mom even knows about it. And so what they did was they portrayed Jennifer as a party girl and basically were blaming her. This is because as the story continues to unfold, Chambers, he continues to spin the narrative that it was rough sex that was initiated by Jennifer. And that was the reason for her quote unquote accidental death. And, you know, the press, we know how the press is. The press loves a good story. Like all the media is like, ooh, we're going to jump on this. We don't know shit, but we're just going to run with the what seems like the woo, get the selling newspapers or getting people to watch the news kind of thing.
Right, which is a PR crisis for everybody who's not the media.
Right.
For everybody else
right.
involved.
Exactly. So the story was that there were these two spoiled rich kids whose night just spun out of control. And obviously it couldn't have been further from the truth what happened. Chambers' father hired defense attorney Jack Littman and his partner Roger Stavis. And Jack Littman had a reputation for making the victims look bad in order to save his clients. And Littman fueled the press by claiming that Jennifer was really to blame, which that just makes me so mad when I hear that over and over and over again, that they're blaming her, you know?
Right, that there's victim blaming happening when no victim should ever be at fault for anything ever.
Right.
They're the victim.
Exactly. 100%. So, and Chambers' looks also played into the story. So everyone's looking at this kid like he is attractive. I mean, I think he has kind of a weird chin, but that's just me. But that he was too good looking and he's too polished to be a murderer. He's never been arrested before. The trouble that he's been in has been buried. And so nobody really knows about it. It is what it is. But so it comes out that Jennifer and Robert had been dating over that summer. And Jennifer even told her friends that they had a sexual relationship and it was the best sex that she ever had. And according to Chambers, their relationship was super casual and she was more serious about him than he was about her. And, you know, her friends all said that she really liked him a lot and that she talked about him a lot, but she was going away to school and like she wasn't like, oh, I'm going to stay for Robert. Like, there was
nothing like that. It wasn't that deep to her. It wasn't worth not going to school for him.
Right, exactly. It was probably pretty casual for her as well, which is, you know, again, why the press is like, oh, she's a slut. She's a party girl. Like, we're just gonna, you know, it's her fault. She did this. She made this happen. So the prosecutor that was assigned to the case was Linda Fairstein, and she'd never tried a murder case before. And she, again, is a woman, and not a lot of women in the district attorney's office at that time. And that guy that Stephen Sirocco, that was originally the one that came down and got the videotape confession, he thought that he was going to get the case. But because he was witness to the videotape confession, he couldn't try the case. So he was kind of pissed when they took it away from him and when they gave it to Linda. But anyway, it was what it was. And so together, her and Detective Sheehan built a case against Chambers. Sheehan had Chambers' address book because he had taken it with him when he went down there for questioning in the first place. It's like a date book or whatever, not maybe an address book, but like a date book more. And so he interviewed a bunch of people that were in it. And at first everybody was like, oh my God, no, he would never, he's incapable. He could never do something like that. And then as time went on, people started to kind of like give them some damning information. So the more they dug, the more information that people started to share. And people said stuff like he went to parties and he stole fur coats and jewelry from the houses of the parties he attended. He took pills out of medicine cabinets. Like, he's just a piece of shit.
He's just a dirty douchebag.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, he's a drug addict. He went to rehab, but he didn't complete the rehab program.
See, I called it. Did I not call it?
You did call it.
I mean, he went, but I knew he wasn't. I knew there was something off about him.
Yeah.
This rehab thing was just a front.
Exactly.
Wasn't real.
Right. It's his mom's attempt to make him, again, poor Robert, please let him off the hook.
I feel like that wouldn't make you seem any better if you're like, oh, my son's a drug addict.
Right.
Please don't press charges against him. It's like, oh, your son's a drug addict. We're probably going to press charges against him because he'll just steal the credit card again.
Right. I don't understand how she played on people's sympathies and didn't get anything done. Like, nothing was ever done to him.
Yeah, I don't either.
Especially if it started when he was like 14 and this is when he's 19. So this is 5 years, presumably, of repeated shit going down, right?
Well, I feel like we hear this all the time, that a lot of the time there's like not ever any accountability for these people. Like, they don't have to, they answered no one basically, and there's no repercussions for any of their actions.
Yeah.
So he's just another example of this. I as you're building this story, he just seems like another example.
Yeah, for sure. 100%. You are definitely not wrong. I just always think, I don't know, I'm a mother, you're my kid, you have to hold them accountable. So I don't understand the, like, I understand protecting you as like a mama bear, but if you're super fucking up, I'm gonna let you fall so you stop fucking up, you know?
Yeah.
At some point, I'm letting you hit the ground so that you realize there is a fucking ground that you will hit and you need to figure your shit out.
Right.
But I guess I'm just a different kind of parent.
Come back down to earth.
Yeah. But that's my my parenting style. So anyway, he had a cocaine habit, as I said before, and he couldn't afford it. And so he was stealing from people to pay for using cocaine and other stuff, just partying, drinking, like living this life, you know, going out, hanging out at these bars, going to places that he couldn't really afford to be at, especially because he doesn't have a job either. And he's not from a wealthy family.
A healthy New York wannabe socialite lifestyle.
Exactly. But again, his mom put him into it.
Yeah. Bad choice on her part.
Yeah. She created the monster. While they were putting together a case against Chambers, listen to this, Daphne. Fairstein got a call from another detective in another precinct who had been investigating a string of burglaries. And I never heard this before. So this is fucking wild. So Chambers' driver's license had been found on the balcony of one of these high-rise fancy apartment buildings that had been burglarized. So several of the apartments in the apartment building had been burglarized. And when he was called in for questioning, because his driver's license is on the balcony of one of these apartments, he's like, oh my gosh, my wallet got stolen. Thank God you found my driver's license. And the detective, she's a woman. And so she literally admitted that she was charmed by his good looks and the fact that he had no prior arrests. And considering his quote unquote background, they no longer considered him a suspect. And basically, here's your driver's license. We're so sorry for inconveniencing you and bringing you down here. But as it turns out, because they had his fingerprints now, because he's been arrested for murder, that his fingerprints were on a medicine cabinet of one of these apartments. And so what happened was he's this white guy, right? And he would go into these apartment buildings because he either knew the doorman, because he knew people that lived in the building, and they'd be like, oh, hey, I'm just here visiting so-and-so. And he would just let him in, right? So then he'd go down the hallways of these apartment buildings and he'd try all the doors until he found one that was open and nobody's home. And then he goes in and he's stealing the shit, right? And he's throwing it over the balcony to this guy whose name is David Villa, who this guy is an African-American guy. He's 20 years old and he's a known drug dealer. And so between the two of them and these break-ins, they stole $70,000 worth of stuff.
Oh, God. And that's in the 80s. So that's like even more today, A. And B, he's using this to pay his drug dealer for drugs, right? I assume.
Yeah. Yeah. So totally. And I mean, like, I was reading this case, like, on the internet, looking up all this stuff, and I never, ever saw anything about this. And so when I watched that documentary, because I finally decided that, because that documentary, again, was her family and friends more telling her story and how they were really upset about the way she was portrayed in the media.
Right. Which is also our values here, that we want to bring awareness to the victim and their truth.
Exactly. So it was a 5-part documentary series, and I watched the whole thing because I wanted to get all the information. And I'm really glad I did, because then I found this out, right? And so then this guy, this David Villa that Robert was going around stealing with, was later convicted of aggravated rape because he raped and stabbed a college student 5 times, and he was sentenced to 10 to 20 years. So this is the kind of people he's hanging out with.
That's all he got, was 10 to 20 years for raping and stabbing someone?
Yeah, well, the girl didn't die. Hello?
Oh, no.
Right?
That's fucked.
Yeah, so fucked.
Yeah, let's just send this violent, aggressive, drug-dealing human back to the streets. What can happen?
Right?
What will go wrong?
So, okay, so now listen to this. I could not find out what happened to Robert Chambers over all of this. Like, it was not anywhere else in the documentary other than the fact that they brought it up, right? The docuseries. And so I looked it up online to see, like, did he get charged? Because $70,000, that's a lot of freaking money. That's like, that's definitely felony money, right? And his fingerprints were found at one of the places. Well, he was
in- And his ID, like, duh.
Yeah.
Red flag alert.
Ugh, yeah. This guy, man.
Right. These sirens should be going off in your head right now.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
Huh, let's connect some dots.
Exactly. So he's indicted for this crime, but he had a different lawyer. So this is going on while he's under investigation for Jennifer Levin's murder, right? And, but it's, so he had to hire a different lawyer for this. And he basically said that the guy forced him to do it, or he threatened to kill him or threatened to hurt him or whatever. And so he's forced into doing it. But I mean, given everything, I feel like that's bullshit. But I also couldn't find out if anything happened, and I think nothing did happen because I couldn't find anything.
Well, I feel like a lot of the times, like if you look at the, like Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker, I think a lot of his charges are rolled together just so it would be, you know, like multiple life sentences or whatever. But then they weren't going to charge him on the sidelines as well for like, I don't want to call this like a petty misdemeanor. But, you know, for robbing, for burglarizing, for theft, whatever, call right. it whatever you want, all the same, basically.
Right.
Yeah, that they're going to charge him for, I would assume, like, these things are rolled together. However, that would make no sense for reparation to the victims of the theft.
But wait, but they're not. And so, wait, listen to this. This is where I'm just like, this is the whole thing where as I'm reading it and I'm again, oh, I know this case and I'm just going to whip it out really quickly. No, all this fucking shit keeps happening. I'm like, what the fuck? What the fuck? What the actual fuck? So anyway,
say that one more time.
What the actual fuck?
Yes.
Right. So the prosecution had Jennifer's jean jacket sent for DNA testing, which was brand new at the time. And it was determined that the jacket had Jennifer's blood and saliva on it, and most likely was the murder weapon used to strangle her. However,
her own jacket was?
Mm-hmm.
That's so sad.
Yeah.
Not her new jean jacket.
No. I know.
Poor baby.
Poor sad. I mean, very sad. Very sad. Poor girl. So, but the judge didn't allow the evidence because it was not considered to be reliable at the time because DNA is brand new. And so, yeah, they didn't let that happen. Also, the judge did not allow into evidence Chambers' drug use, his burglaries, or the fact that Jennifer's money was missing from her wallet and her jewelry was also missing.
What the fuck?
Yeah.
Right? Let's take away all the evidence.
Yeah, it's super. This judge, I don't even get it. And like in the trial, they put up this picture of Jennifer on the night that she was murdered or the night, you know, she's out with her friends. There's pictures of her. And they had to put like tape over her ears because they couldn't show her earrings because in the crime scene photos, she doesn't have earrings because the fucker stole them. But they couldn't, like, they literally had to black them out in the picture that they had of her in the court.
That's so fucked.
Yeah. Because, oh, you can't bring that into evidence that we think he stole her shit.
That's so fucked.
So fucked. And the detective kind of said that he thought that maybe the whole motive for the murder was to rob her and not even to actually kill her.
I don't know. I feel like this guy wanted to rob her and probably kill her because he sounds like an aggressive, violent, pent-up piece of shit.
Exactly.
Anyway, also, do we know more about this judge? Did you find out anything else about this judge?
I did not do a whole lot of research on the judge because I was rabbit-holing in a whole lot of other directions on this thing because I was trying to find about that David Falvilla and some other...
The drug dealer.
The drug dealer that was, you know, convicted for aggravated rape. So and
bodily injury.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I was just wondering about the judge because I was wondering if this is like his MO a lot to like leave out evidence if he's almost like a victim blamer too.
Well, no, but listen to this. Because this is why I didn't rabbit hole on the judge, because I think kind of everything we need to know is in this next little bit that I'm going to tell
okay,
you.
Okay, I gotcha.
Okay, so while awaiting trial, Chambers was let out on bond. And of course, the prosecution's like, no, don't let this fucker out on bond, you know, because he's, you know, just a piece of shit. But anyway, the reason that the defense was trying to get him out on bond was because he had never been arrested before and partially because his mother, Phyllis Chambers, convinced Father Theodore McCarrick, who was the Archbishop of Newark at the time, to write a letter to the judge recommending that bail be granted. And this weighed heavily on the judge's decision. So the judge is getting a letter from this archbishop, so a super high up.
Right.
Person in the Catholic Church saying, oh no, he's a good boy. Let him out on bail. And so the judge does.
Did they even try to fucking feel out that connection? Why he would say any of that?
Well, because he had attended that guy's church and the mom, like I said before, she was right. An Irish immigrant. So Catholic, very involved in the church.
Okay.
Yeah.
So they did actually know each other. It wasn't just a random person that she's like, please help my son.
No.
That she's crying, poor mom, poor son.
Right. No, they know the priest.
Okay.
So, but anyway, I feel like...
That's fucked.
Yeah, I feel like a priest shouldn't convince a judge to do anything. But so...
When we go to post this episode, we're going to have to check the explicit box like a million times. I've said that's fucked way too many times, even for my own comfort level.
Dial it back. Dial it back. That's fucked.
That's fucked.
So the trial began in January of 1988. So this is like, what, a year and a half after this has happened. And mind you, he's out on bail this whole time, right? And so the press is going wild with this story from 1986 to 1988. Everything that's coming out here, there, and everything in between. And there's this quote-unquote sex diary that the prosecution, that the defense is trying to get into court, get admitted into the court before the proceedings happen. And so the newspaper gets a hold of Jennifer's sex diary, and I'm using air quotes here. You can't see me doing it, but I'm doing it, air quotes, sex diary. But what it actually was it was her daytimer. So it was her address book, daytimer, date planner, whatever, that was so innocuous that she literally kept it in the kitchen of her dad's apartment.
I believe we call those planners that just have a contact list within them.
Yeah, exactly.
And yeah, that's wow. the defense was trying to bring that in.
Yeah. And they, again, went public with it to the media, calling it her sex diary.
So they're going to let that into evidence, but her jacket and her earrings can't be let into evidence?
Yeah, exactly. Well, they didn't end up letting it go in. And again, as I said, it's totally innocuous because it's not a sex diary. It's a fucking day planner.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
stupid.
Yeah. And she kept it, like I said, in the kitchen of her dad's apartment, in their apartment. So if it's her sex diary, I feel like it's not going to be next to the fridge where your dad can pick it up and read it.
Yeah. Huh. What is this? Michael Jones at 4 p.m. Meet at the Bronx Hotel.
I like how you go to the Bronx.
They're in New York.
Yeah, that's true. True, true. So anyway, so his lawyer is slut-shaming her, putting her on trial in the media, right? And it's just like, ugh, I can't even with this fucking lawyer, right? He's a total douchebag. He's known to do shit like that, to make his clients, to do whatever he can to get his clients off and blame the victim and yada yada and all
that. That's stuff. A really good lawyer, but an extremely immoral human.
Exactly. So the case, unfortunately, was so tainted by misconceptions of both Jennifer and Chambers that it would be impossible to get a jury who was not influenced in one way or another. One of the jurors, they said literally when they were not an actual juror, but one of the ones that came in, like
an interviewee juror.
Yeah. On the panel, literally said when she was sitting there, oh my God, he's way more good looking in real life.
Ew.
Yeah. So, I mean,
get better people that you think are hot. Like, what the fuck? He's right? On trial for murder. Don't be one of those psychopaths.
Well, and again, it's to the point of...
It's all tainted.
Yeah, it's tainted. Like, he's rich, she's rich, she's a slut, she deserved it. Poor kid, this poor guy, you know, it was an accident. She was trying to rape him. She wanted rough sex, you know.
Ugh.
Yeah, ugh, is right. It's all bad. It makes me just super, again, super frustrated and irritated with this lawyer. So all of the evidence that Farstein and Sheehan had gathered to accurately depict Chambers' character once the case went on trial, would never be heard in trial because his lawyers kept him from taking the stand. They chose to not. They were going to put him on the stand and then they chose not to put him on the stand. And because they didn't put him on the stand, they couldn't open the door for all this shit to be brought in because the judge had already said that it couldn't be brought in. But if Chambers would have got on the stand, then they could have asked him all these questions that would have, again, depicted what his real character is like, right?
A grit. Again, great legal counsel, immoral fucking lawyer.
Exactly.
A grin.
Because Jennifer's friends took the stand so that they could explain what happened and like her, like how Jennifer was and like how she was dating Robert and blah, blah, blah. All of her sexual history and everything could be brought into court, which is bullshit because it's that whole thing of like, if a guy sleeps with two or three girls, like it's all cool and cool. But if a girl sleeps with two or three guys, she's a fucking slut.
Right. Absolutely. It's this double standard that's fucked.
Yeah, exactly. Especially in the 80s. I mean, before the 80s also, but yeah, it's all bad. So the jury was in deliberation for such a long time. It was clear that they weren't going to be able to reach a verdict. And so both the defense and the prosecution are like getting nervous. They're like, fuck, this isn't going to look good for either one of us if it's a hung jury and we don't get a verdict. So Roger Stavis, who again is Jack Littman's partner, who's the main defense attorney, goes to Linda Farstein's office to see if they can work out a plea bargain. And Farstein has to get it approved by Stephen and Ellen Levin, so those are Jennifer's parents, before she can accept the terms of the plea bargain, right? And if they don't choose to accept the plea deal, they would have to go through another trial. And they didn't want to live through that again. So they went ahead and let him take a plea deal. And subsequently, Chambers accepted a plea bargain, which required him to plead guilty to first degree manslaughter. And wait for it. He was sentenced to only 15 years in prison. 5 to 15. 5 to 15 is what he was sentenced
to. Gross. Manslaughter?
Yeah.
That does not seem consistent with manslaughter.
Nope. But it was because it was going to be a hung jury because they were all fucking tainted by the media.
Right.
And the parents didn't want to live through it again because they said that the mom like cried every single day because they made her daughter look terrible.
Well, yeah, as you would.
Yeah. Not only are you reliving this
traumatic, horrible, fucking awful event.
Right.
Then violent death. Then they're playing your daughter out to be this party girl, sex maniac slut who likes it rough and got too rough with a guy. And now he's on trial for killing her.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just going to your own child's murder trial at, you know, the case against whomever murdered them would be horrible as is. And then just to add the horrible misconceptions about the case into it. Yeah. Fuck that.
Yeah. It's
bad. People suck.
They do suck. So 5 to 15 years. 5 to fucking 15 years. So shortly after his conviction, a videotape surfaced. So somebody took it to, there used to be this show called The Current Affair, and they took the videotape to the TV studio or whatever, gave it to the Current Affair people. And the guy who was going to do the Current Affair story brought the detective down to show him the video. And it was fucking Robert Chambers partying with friends while he was on bond for Jennifer Levin's murder, strangling a fucking doll. And he said, oops, I think I killed it. Like, he was mocking Jennifer's death.
I hope he drops the soap. I hope he drops every single bar of soap every day he showers right in prison.
Well, keep in mind, this is 1988. So 15 years, he's out. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's out. The Levins sued Chambers for $25 million in a civil suit for wrongful death. So it's kind of like what Ronald Goldman's family did with the O.J. Simpson trial.
I was just about to say, yeah. Nicole Brown Simpson.
Yeah.
Butchered that. But yeah, Nicole Brown Simpson.
Yeah. But Ronald Goldman's parents sued O.J. Simpson for wrongful death.
Good.
So same kind of thing. And Chambers pled no contest and was ordered to pay the Levins in a lump sum and to have his wages garnished for 10% up until the debt's paid. But I'm guessing he's not going to fucking pay it because he's a drug addict and he's going to get $25 million.
Well, he's not going to pay all $25 million, but his wages will definitely get garnished.
Exactly.
Which is better than nothing. At least there's something happening in that facet.
Right. And again, back to the like Junko Furuta, no amount of money is going to bring your child back or is worth the life of your child. Or like, how do you put a price on that? You don't.
You don't.
No, you don't. It's just, I guess, more about the point of it, right?
Yeah. About the justice.
Yeah. Something, some kind of formal fucking punishment. And he's a rich preppy. Well, not a rich, but he wants to be a wannabe richie.
As you say, in this whole thing, you keep repeating that he's rich. His persona was rich. He wasn't rich.
Yeah, no.
His mom just wanted him to look like a little rich boy.
Exactly.
He wasn't at all.
No, he wasn't. So Chambers' first eligibility for parole was in 1994. And Jennifer's mother, Ellen, spoke before the parole board and said, in quote, in my eyes, anything less than the maximum would devalue my daughter's life. So at that time, he was denied parole. So in 1996, he was again eligible for parole. And at that time, when he went for the parole board, according to transcripts of the hearing, he said at one point, I quote, I guess I could also give you the party line and say that I've learned my lesson and I will never do this again. But that's not how I feel at this moment because I have a lot of conflicting emotions.
Yeah, that's going to get you somewhere.
What the fuck?
Yeah, he's a narcissistic tool.
Yeah. I have a lot of conflicting emotions, and I'm not saying that I wouldn't ever kill anybody again.
Yeah, I have a lot of conflicting emotions right now, too, about killing him.
Yeah, he's a something.
Yeah, he sure as shit is.
Yeah, he is. So again, mind you, he was sentenced to 5 to 15 years, right?
Uh-huh.
So while he was in prison, he spent 1,592 days in total in solitary confinement, which is almost 5 years.
Probably for his own protection, I would assume.
No, it's because he continues to be a fucking piece of shit while he's in jail. So he served the whole 15-year sentence because, again, he's fucking up left and right and he ends up kept going. He went multiple times to solitary confinement for almost 30 offenses, including failing drug tests, marijuana and heroin in his cell.
What the fuck?
Yep. Fighting with guards and having a straight razor in his possession. So almost 30 fucking times of this kind of shit.
What the fuck?
Right?
I just want to know, I don't ever want to experience this, but I would really love to know how this chain of command and supply and demand and everything of that nature works within prison systems. Like, how the fuck are you keistering a razor blade out of your visitation rooms?
Yeah. I don't know. Maybe you could do an episode on that.
Keistering razor blades.
Right. The official guide to keistering a razor blade, as written by Daphne.
I think I shall write an up.
What shall you do?
Write a novel.
Yes, I feel like you should.
Most not definitely. A
navel orange?
Yes. Mm. Hopefully not a different kind of navel.
Right.
Not gonna keister. That wouldn't even be keistering.
Oh my gosh. Alrighty then.
Okay, shove that in your marijuana.
Right? So, also, while he was in prison, he had a girlfriend the whole time, and her name was Sean Covell, and he began dating her right after he was released on bail awaiting trial for Jennifer's murder. And she can be seen in the video of him strangling the doll.
Ew!
Yeah. Yep. Because she's there partying with him because she's his girlfriend.
This guy must have a magic stick.
Yeah.
How they say that women have voodoo clams. This guy must have a magic stick.
A voodoo clam?
Because he's charging, English is good. He's just charming everybody fucking left, right, and center.
Yeah.
Everybody's like, oh no, he could never. He's such a good guy.
It's well, like, even that detective was like.
Yeah, that's exactly to my point. They find his ID and she's like, oh, I'm sorry for the inconvenience, Mr. Chambers.
Mr. Hottie McHottington.
Yeah.
You go run along on your way and go be hot.
Yeah, right. You go run along and have a nice stroll in the park on your way, sir.
Right. And I'm be so hot sorry. While you're doing it.
I'm so sorry for inconveniencing your day. Let me accidentally slip my phone number next to your ID while I hand it back to you.
Right.
Magic stick.
Okay. So this Sean Covell, she visited him every week while he was in prison, and she remained loyal the whole entire 15 years. And when he was released from prison, they got an apartment together on 57th Street. And after he was released in 2003, he was arrested multiple times for kind of misdemeanor drug offenses. And then in 2007, Chambers and Covell were both arrested for selling cocaine and heroin out of their apartment.
Jeez.
Yeah.
Gross.
And because the judge was so horrified by Sean Covell's appearance when she was arrested, because like they saw her throughout the whole thing because she's visiting Chambers. She's like on TV. She's in pictures. Blah, blah, blah. Like she's this cute, normal looking girl. Right. And then like in that arrest picture of her, she looks horrible, like terrible. So the judge was so horrified by her appearance that he sent her to rehab and just let her off with probation. But wait for it. Fucking wait for it. Which this is justice, but pisses me off. So Chambers was sentenced to 19 years and 4 months. More time than he got for killing Jennifer. 19 years for cocaine and heroin, but 15 for murder. So what the fuck? I mean, I'm glad he's doing 19 more years because he should have had that and then some for Jennifer.
Yeah.
So it's kind of poetic justice. Ooh, but
19 years, 2003. He's out this year.
Nope. 2024. No, because it was 2007.
Oh, I thought you said 2003.
Yeah. So no, he's eligible for parole in January of 2024. And at that point, he'll be 57 years old and will have spent half of his life behind bars.
Dirty piece of shit.
Nice.
I had to sing it. Okay. We're in New York for this episode.
Alrighty. Yes, Broadway. Broadway, here Daphne comes.
Yeah, fucking dick.
Okay, but
wait. And fucking dick of a justice system.
Right. Okay, and then another side note, because I keep going, oh, side note, side note, side note, because there's so many fucking side notes in this, right?
Yeah, right.
This is like I said, oh, I know this case. No, the fuck I didn't know this case. Anyway, lots of language.
The fuck I did.
The fuck I did. Okay, anyway, another side note, that Father McCarrick, who wrote the letter to the judge.
Yeah.
And it was probably mostly the reason that Chambers got bail while he was awaiting trial. In 2018, he was defrocked by the Catholic Church because of sexual abuse charges that were substantiated by a young boy from like many, many moons ago. So prior to, like, probably right around the time of the Chambers trial, and it, maybe even before that.
I don't want to talk about the Catholic Church.
Yeah, no, I don't want to get into that either. So I was debating whether to put it in or not.
No, I think it's worthwhile that to show that he's just also an untrustworthy.
Yeah.
That not only, like, he was essentially schmoozed by mom to write this letter because he's like, oh, she's a good church patron. I'll write her. I'll do her a favor, write this letter, even though her son's going on trial for murder, to attempt to get him on bond, out on bond for the time being, like while he's facing trial. But he's also, in his own rights, just a piece of shit. He didn't just get schmoozed. He's also a dirty, gross human. So that was worth mentioning. But I also just don't want to dig into the Catholic Church. They're too powerful.
They are too powerful. And, you know, just because there are a few bad apples, there's a few bad apples everywhere. But, okay, so in that docuseries, the detective said that after that came out, that he thought that there was potential that maybe that priest had done something to Robert Chambers because he would have been the right age when all that stuff was going down with the priest that was accused. And Chambers would have been kind of like a ripe target for him because his parents were divorced. So he's coming from a broken home. He's a troubled kid, obviously.
Lost and broken.
Right. And the prosecutor, Linda Fairstein, she said she didn't think that that was the case. But of course, Chambers never said anything and have no way of knowing.
Right.
But then you kind of wonder.
His pride would be too bruised if he ever came forward, if it was true, if that did happen or not.
When you kind of wonder, though, if that's not why the priest wrote the letter.
Yeah, no, I'm seeing the exact same thing as like a, hey, my son told me about what you did. You're my priest. So I'm never going to do anything about this. Or bishop, sorry, archbishop.
He was an archbishop, yeah.
Yeah, you're my bishop. You're my higher in the church. If you write this, I won't report you.
Well, and maybe not even that, but maybe the archbishop's own guilt, you know? And
right.
Maybe. But I don't, again, totally speculation and again, a few bad apples. So we're going to move on from that.
Yeah, we mostly only hear about the bad, not the good. So yeah. There's also that.
Exactly. And then on a positive note, Ellen Levin was able to lobby for victims' rights and she was able to help get 13 bills passed, including not being able to bring up victims' sexual history into a trial. So rape victims, murder victims, anyone who's a victim, no matter, you know, whether it's rape or whatever it is, their sexual history is not allowed to be brought up in court.
I'm assuming unless that's by relevancy.
Well, but if they're a victim.
Yeah, but sometimes it could be a victim who's like a prostitute with a log.
Doesn't matter.
Oh.
So if a prostitute,
I feel like that would only help the case, though, if they had a log.
Yeah, but if a sex worker gets raped, then just because she's a sex worker doesn't mean she deserves to get raped.
No. That's not to my point. My point is that if, say, fucking Heidi Fleiss, one of her girls, kept a book,
mm-hmm.
and then one of them got murdered, I think the last person in the appointment slot before, or like after, or before the murder, right? Before or after, in this time frame, if there's a person on the log anywhere near that time frame, it might be worthwhile to bring that into evidence that this was on the person's book.
Right. At least something good came out of it.
No, that is good.
Yeah.
And yeah, that wasn't to my point. My point was just that I feel like in some instances it could be helpful. But yeah, not if it's on the grounds of like shaming or victim blaming or trying to have a skewed view of it in any sort of way, like in this case that they did.
Right. And Ellen said too in that docuseries that she thought that she was brought to doing that by Jennifer because someone approached her about doing it. And at first she's like, I've never read a bill before and I don't know anything about it. But then once she started getting involved, then like I said, she lobbied for 13 bills to be passed. So anyway, that show was called The Preppy Murder, Death in Central Park, and it was an AMC docuseries that aired in November of 2019. And that's where I got the better part of my information. I also got some other information from a few other sources, and those will be cited in the show notes. Daphne, thoughts?
It's fucked. That's my initial thought.
Okay.
Like, I feel like the way this is set up, like, obviously he's the one, obviously he did it. Last person to be seen with, yes, it's Robert Chambers. Jennifer has scratches all over her body that are consistent with strangulation and that it obviously wasn't just a cut and dry oops accident. And if it was an oops accident, why are you a pansy ass bitch that didn't call for help. If it was a genuine accident,
right?
Why does that happen?
Right. There's no.
Well, that's like people who flee the scene after they get into a car accident, and they could might have some kind of sense that the person in the other car could be injured because they're drunk. They're just not taking accountability. They drank and drove, and then they decided to get into their vehicle drunk, get into a car accident, hurt this other. That's a poor analogy, I suppose. But same concept is that, like, if this was a genuine accident, genuine mistake, she was getting a little too aggressive with him for his taste, and then he accidentally flipped her because he didn't like it, you would do something about that. You'd be like, oh, fuck, what the fuck did I just do?
Right.
Right? Not flee the scene, and then also stand by and watch the police as they're coming to collect evidence and take pictures of the crime scene. Like, you wouldn't stand as like a looker on to the crime scene.
No.
You would be right there being involved, like, because you just called by yourself, being like, what the fuck? You would be there. And also, it's very evident and clear that he did it and that the media just fucking sucks.
Yeah, that's
they just
very clear.
Fucked it up. They just fucked it all up for him.
Yeah, they fucked it all up for Jennifer and getting justice for Jennifer. And his lawyer had a big, big impact in that.
Yeah.
So,
like I said, his lawyer, great legal counsel, horrible human.
Right. And his lawyer started out as a prosecutor. So, but I think a lot of defense attorneys kind of start that way. And then, you know, whether it's the lure of the money or the lure of actually wanting to help innocent people, I'm not sure. That's a whole different thing. We're not even going to go there.
Wait, prosecutors don't get paid as much. Those are state attorneys.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. They flip to being defense attorneys, maybe the lure of the money, maybe actual justice.
I think it flips most other ways, though. I think people go from being defense lawyers in, like, in this instance, like, in the case of violent crime, they'll go from being a defense attorney and then, like, they can't take it anymore. Like, they have a conscience that gets in the way of doing it after so long. Like, you know how, like, therapists eventually retire?
Yeah.
Cops eventually retire because it's just hard to endure these things on a daily basis. That they go to the prosecution side then to try and seek the justice.
Right.
Not weasel their way out of the justice. But anyway, I think that this guy's a piece of shit. I'm happy he's locked up. Let's get him locked up some more. Somebody keister some shit, bring it to him. Let's get him some more time. Somebody pick a fight with him in prison. Let's get him some more time.
Well, I feel like he's just going to get out and do the same thing anyway.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's the not that I'm trying to figure out how to phrase what I'm going to say. Unfortunately, the recidivism, I believe is the word that I'm looking for, rate in prison is so fucking high because there's no sense of rehabilitation in the United States while prisoners are in prison, which is sad for 15-year-olds that were caught dealing weed that get a 10-year sentence.
Right.
But for somebody like him, good, let's keep sending him back there.
Yeah, exactly.
Because he is a violent person, obviously. And obviously with the intent to sell heroin, that's just a death sentence on somebody else. Sorry, I'm just spewing all my thoughts over here.
That's okay. I just hope that I wasn't too all over the place because, like I said, this had a lot of twists and turns and it went back and forth between what happened prior, what happened during, what happened leading up to. And so I was just trying to piece it all together as I was reading it. So hopefully I did the case justice, and yeah, thanks for listening.
No, I think you did a great job, Mom. Thank you for this one. I heard this case on a show, but it was just like a single 45-minute. Yeah, I didn't know about half of it. I just knew that she died and that she was portrayed as a party girl. But then also within the show, her friends and her family were like, no, she wasn't a party girl. I didn't watch the 5-part series that you watched, but I watched like a single 40-minute episode on a show one time a couple years ago. So I was familiar, but not to this extent. And holy fuck.
Yeah.
Like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
God, people suck.
Yes, they do.
He sucks.
Yeah.
Fuck you, Robert Chambers.
Right. Long story short, too late. You suck, Robert Chambers.
Yeah. Yeah. Fucking magic stick my ass. All right. Thanks.
Thanks for listening.